I appreciate Don's willingness to stand in and lend a hand. And the last round he was in Job, and now he's going to carry on in some more of Job. And so there'll be more exposure to an Old Testament book. And again, I thank him for being willing to help out in this. We have now 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today, we will be tying off the conference in Gridley, California. And so that means we have more prep to finish in that time. So this helps me in more ways than one. Not only did it mean I had time to get some things done this last week, but it also means that I don't have to write a sermon synopsis, and I've got one more to do. And so we're one more biggie on it. The last one was 2,600 words. We got in early enough last night for me to make the corrections and get it out, so I didn't have to worry about it. That helps me too. And, you know, we have this ongoing, I don't know what you want to call it. We travel down to Woodburn together and back, so we have an extra 2 hours of class. And we end up with some good discussions. And I appreciate it. We've had a good time with it. Don, come and share what God's on your heart. And I've got the recorder on already.
Oh, it's already recorded? Okay.
You're on. Candy.
Okay. That means I don't want to say anything too ornery to begin with. But I was just thinking, Courtney, you should get used to that, somebody calling on you like that, because Dave has done that to me over the years many a time. So you need to get used to that early, because it may be something that you'll find in the future happens again. No, it's a good thing to always be willing to speak, and I've tried to make it a habit of if an opportunity comes along, I will say yes before I think about it, because if I think about it, I can find excuses. But, you know, if the Lord gives you an opportunity and it comes your way, then probably He'll give you something to say, and if you've been a good student of the book, you'll be studying something anyway, and so the opportunity comes along, and it's just time to see what you've learned and see what God has for you to say. Before we begin, let's have just a word of thanksgiving, and then we're going to look at the book of Job again. Heavenly Father, we're thankful today for your word and for the clarity with which it teaches. We realize, Father, that in this world we live today, people so often are looking for answers and seeking what is true and what is not true, and repeating the question that Pilate said so long ago, what is truth? And we don't have to ask that question, Father, because we possess in our hands the book that is the truth. It contains the things we need to know. And while it may not answer every question that we would have or like to ask, yet it still tells us the things that we need. And we're thankful, Father, that we have a time together, that we can have the freedom still in this country to look into your word and to not be afraid of what might happen as a consequence of our being here. So bless our time together, Father, and may the Holy Spirit, who is the author of Scripture, also the teacher, may he be here, and Father, may he open our eyes and help us to understand the things that would be beneficial and helpful to us. We'd ask now, for Jesus' sake, amen. When I thought about speaking again, I thought I wasn't going to go to the book of Job. I wasn't going to come back here again. I thought, well, that's not really an appropriate book, particularly for a Sunday morning. But one of the things you find, and I recall Pastor Dave saying that too, when he was looking for a series, he kept asking the Lord what to do. And something would come to mind and say, well, what should I be preaching on, Lord? And something would come to mind. And eventually, after 3 or 4 times, you get the message. That's probably what the Lord wants you to talk about. And so with the book of Job, I was tempted not to do it again, but something said it needed to be done. So as you come to the book of Job, I think most Christians do know the story of the book of Job. But what we don't always recognize is that Job had a fourth comforter. Now, the three friends or comforters, I suppose that's a generous thing to call them friends or comforters, because when you read through the things they said to Job, they weren't exactly friendly and they definitely weren't comforting. But there was a fourth man that came on the scene, and we mentioned him last week. And we said that sometime perhaps we'd go look at him, Job's fourth comforter. And so we're going to do that this morning. Now, we did say, if you recall, that this man is really not named at the end of the book. If you look at chapter 42 for just a moment, and we're going to be jumping around in the book of Job, primarily there, so it won't be too hard to keep up. We'll be mostly in the book of Job, and there'll be a few references to other places. But now, in Job 42, in the scripture reading this morning, you see the conclusion. Job realized that he said things he didn't understand, and in his suffering, he spoke like many people would. He spoke from his feelings, he spoke from his emotions, and he didn't really know what he was talking about, and he admits that. But then in the 7th verse, you read, And so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, "My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has." So, Job spoke what was right. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar did not. But now, the funny thing about that all is, the last man who spoke immediately before God spoke to Job face to face, and that was Elihu. Now, I don't read in verse 7, and I don't think you can read either, that God said that Elihu said something that was wrong. It didn't say, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends and the young fellow that was with you. You don't see that. So evidently, you could take it for granted that he's not named as having said anything wrong. So what he said was right. Now, we're going to go into that, but before we do so, let me remind you that last week, or 2 weeks ago, I believe it was now, for the benefit of those of you who weren't here, we did introduce the book of Job, and I want to bring back some of its key points, because Job is a fascinating book. I believe it was the first book of the Bible written. Now, it's not the oldest book of the Bible in the material it covers, because Genesis goes back and deals with things that are not recorded in Job, but it is the first book that was written. Now, the reason we believe that is if you were to go, and we're not going to go there, but if you need a reference, look at Genesis chapter 10, verses 25 through 29. Job is going to be in this genealogy, I believe, and this genealogy really doesn't have much to do with what is going on, because in the book of Genesis, you're starting from the first man and the Garden of Eden, and you're working up to, you get to the point where now you have a single man with which God is going to begin to deal with humanity, and of course that man is Abraham, or Abram as he's first known. But in Genesis 10, as it's going through a genealogy from the flood to the Tower of Babel, it follows the line when you come to the section about Shem's descendant, follows the line from which Abraham is going to come. But there's a stop in the middle of it, and there's a spur where it follows someone else. It follows the brother of one of Abraham's ancestors and follows him through a family, and it stops with a man who has a son at the end of the list called Jobab. Jobab, that's an interesting name. Well, there's Donald, it's shortened to Don. I never heard Donald, by the way, when I was a kid, unless I was in trouble. That's why I don't like that name today, Dave. Because when I heard Donald and the middle name together, I was in trouble, which I heard frequently, I will admit. But I believe that when you take the name Jobab and you shorten that name, you'd have Job. Now, we're not going back there, but you can make a note and you can look at it if you did not do so. What would be the reason for a spur off of the line from which Abraham came that goes only down to one man's family that ends with one particular name? What's the point in that being there? The only reason it could be there is because somebody in that line is important. And that somebody, I believe, is the last one. And that is the Job of which the book refers to. And that being the case, if you add things up, and we did last week, this book was written, the events occurred about 200 years, roughly, before the time of Abraham, which makes this the oldest book. This is a long time before Moses is going to come along and write. So this is an old book. And there's some unique points in this book that we mentioned. For example, when you come to this book, you would not have ever seen a dialogue like this. From chapter 38 through 41, God speaks face to face with a man. You don't have anything like that anywhere in the Bible. It's the longest discourse, and it's the only one of its kind where God speaks face to face to a man who's disagreeing with what God has done. In essence, you're going to find, if you read through it, that Job doesn't have a problem with who God is. Job has a problem with what God is doing in his life. That was his problem. But God speaks this man face to face. You won't see anything like that any place in the Bible. You also won't see anything anywhere in the Bible, even vaguely, like what you see in chapters 1 and 2. If you want to know what Satan does when he goes into the presence of God and how he talks and what he acts like, the only place you can see it is in Job 1 and 2. And we looked at that a little bit. And it's fascinating because Satan is not exactly very respectful with God. But without the book of Job, you would never see exactly the type of things that go on the exchange. And I believe that's not unusual. I believe that's probably representative of how Satan approaches God to accuse him for what his children do or to get permission to do it. And there are a lot of things here that are fascinating. For example, did you know that Job knew about the Rephaim? Take a moment. Look at chapter 26 with me. Chapter 25 is a short chapter. And chapter 25 and 26 are very fascinating to me. Because in those chapters, there are at least three doctrinal things mentioned that, while they are not entirely unique to Job, at least this one isn't, it's fascinating to me that Job would have known about the Rephaim. But in verse 5, chapter 26, It says, the dead tremble, those things under the waters and those inhabiting them. The dead tremble. Now, that's not mudim, the Hebrew word that normally would be translated dead. It's a word that you're familiar with. It's Rephaim. You realize Job knew about the Rephaim long before the book of Genesis was written? Well, he knew about them because that's the word. If you had a Hebrew text, you'd see that it is the Rephaim. He's not just talking about people that are dead. He's talking about a particular group of individuals that are not fully human. These are the people in Genesis 6. When the sons of God came together and the daughters of men, there were giants born, and they were known by Nephilim and also Rephaim. And here this man knew. Now, this is not unique, but this is the first reference to them. And you'll find also back at the end of the 25th chapter, you'll find a theme that has begun that is fascinating to me because this is a theme that Jesus himself repeated in Mark 9. He repeats it three times where the worm dies not. His worm dies not. I can't remember the rest of the verse. Don't trust your memory. But it's where the worm dies not. And this idea of the human nature, of fallen human man, is being looked at as like a worm. Look at the 25th chapter of Job and the 8th verse. Now, this is Bildad speaking, and it's his final discourse. And he says, how much is man who is a maggot and the son of a man who is a worm? Looking at what human nature, the twisted human nature, what man is since he's fallen. This idea back here, it's here it is written. This is not unique, but this is the first reference of it. And Jesus, many, many, many years later, is going to refer to the same where the worm dies not. He's going to refer to talking about human nature. Now, there's one that we missed, and I want to show you this one over in chapter 28. This one, I think, is a real eye-opener. We always think of Solomon as being remarkable, and he was. He recorded 3,000 Proverbs. He probably knew more than anybody for a long time before or afterwards. Only the Lord passed him in knowledge. But in the 28th chapter, the 28th verse, you'll find something that is not unique. And this really is a stunning thing. These primitive people back here, and we're going back to a time that is probably, 4,000 years ago, maybe more. And this is when you have primitive man, the hunter-gatherer, as they like to refer to him to get today, this knuckle-scraping Neanderthal. Look what he understood in the 28th chapter, 20th verse. Now it's talking about, this is Job speaking, and he says, and to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. Doesn't that kind of sound like something somebody said a long time after this fact? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that you'll find throughout the book of Job that this is a remarkable book. There are things unique to it. There are things that had its beginning here. And when people look at ancient mankind, well, you young people in school, boy, I'm telling you, if you get this hunter-gatherer image, if they try to talk about how primitive man was so stupid, don't believe it. Just look at the book of Job. Mankind in its earliest years, this goes way back, and there's all sorts of evidence through here. Not only were they intelligent and knew about God, but their society was not such a primitive thing either. Now, when we think about this book then, we want to go back to this man, Elihu, because we're going to talk this morning about this comforter. And our theme is going to be that Elihu is different from the three friends because Elihu did not rebuke Job for what he did before he suffered, but for how he talked and acted while he was suffering. There's a huge difference there. Because Job's three friends, all of them are going to say, Job, you did this and that's now you're suffering. And that's not what Elihu's going to do. We're going to look at it. We're going to go through, and there's quite a few things. We're going to skip through and get the high points. But you're going to see that this man, Elihu, does not say to Job, because you did this or because you were that, now you're suffering. No, he's going to point at what he's doing while he's suffering. And it's very clear from the book. Now, who is Elihu then anyway? Well, in the 32nd chapter, we find this man is introduced. And it does say of him, it tells you something about him. It says, beginning at verse 1 of Job 32, and I'm reading from the New King James, so if it differs from the AV, you'll understand that I'm reading from the New King James. It says, so these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, of the Buzite, of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. So he's the son of Barachel, the Buzite. Now, what do we know about these people? Well, we really don't know much of anything. We really don't know hardly anything about these people. But it's named, so evidently at its time, people would have understood where he was, who he was. Now, I believe this man is a younger man, but now that's given against the fact that Job probably lived the people of his time, and you can go back and see this in Genesis chapter 11. His father and some of his relatives lived about 230 years or even more. And the 42nd chapter of this book ends by saying that Job lived after these events. And if you need to look at it, it's Job 42. In verse 16, it says, after this, after all of these events, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his grandchildren of four generations. So he lived a long time, but now he's portrayed as an older man. So let me suggest, and this is an estimate, that probably at this time Job is somewhere right around 100. And this man, Elihu, to me, he has too many smarts to be too young. So I'm going to guess he's probably 50 to 60 years of age, which in his time was pretty young. Because if men lived to be 240, and this guy's about 50 or 60, he's about like an 18 to 20 year old would be today. But he's got an incredible amount of knowledge. So my guess is Elihu was a youngster, maybe 50, 65 years of age. But to him, 100 would look pretty young. It would look pretty young. Just like today, you talk to a 20-year-old, and if I talk to anybody that I work with and I tell them that I'm over 60, they look at me and they think I should be having a cane and should be walking around having my hearing aids turned up full volume. Well, I'm not quite there yet. I might be close at times, but I'm not quite there. So age is a perspective. You know, as you get older, you'll find out that things that looked old when you were young don't look so old anymore, and they don't look too bad, in fact. Now, Elihu is going to be an interesting person because we don't know exactly when he came on the scene. Back in Job chapter 2, and if you want to look there, you'll see the three friends are going to show up. And it's a sad story because we go back to Job chapter 2 and verse 11. We read, now when Job's three friends heard of all of this adversity that had come upon him, each came from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. Sounds good. They came to comfort him, but that's not exactly how it's going to work out through the book. It's really something. Now, you'll notice it says they came, but you don't find a young man named Eliphaz in this list. Now, he's going to tell you in the 32nd chapter that he was there and he heard everything these three men said. So, at some point, in the 13th verse, we find out, so they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Somewhere in this time, Eliphaz came wandering in. He wasn't named, but I'm going to suggest to you probably sometime in this week he came in, because he was there to hear the discourse, which is going to begin in the third chapter with Job. He has this wonderful lament that curses the day of his birth and says the day shouldn't even exist on which I was born, which tells you that he had quite a change of mind. By the way, what do you suppose changed this man's mind to become discouraged like it was? Because after the first set of events, if you look back at chapter 1, verse 22, it says, in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. After the first round, when he lost his possessions and his family, he didn't have any problem that we can see. He says, in fact, it says, the blessed be the Lord. The Lord's given, the Lord's taken away. But now in the third chapter, all of a sudden, now he's got this terrible lament. And he's despondent. He's discouraged. I wonder where that came from. Well, let me suggest something. In that week that we find, those 7 days, someone came along and was whispering in Job's ears how terrible it was, how he didn't deserve what happened, how it shouldn't have been to him. Who do you suppose would have done that? Now, you don't see Satan here, but we know from the second chapter, Satan was saying, let me at him. Let me at him. I can show you God. He'll sin. I'll make him. And so, to me, when you look at this, you see Satan is behind the scene. You don't see him named as coming to this man. But when you look at the New Testament, you find Satan puts things in the working of the mind. And all of a sudden, this man is now despondent. He's had time to stew on what's going on in his life. And you know, if you sit and feel sorry for yourself long enough, you're inviting somebody to come along and give you some ideas that will really help you. If you really want to feel sorry and you start stewing enough, sit there and do it for a while, and you might find that someone comes along and gives you some real doozies of thoughts. And that someone is Satan, and he's not really going to help you at all. So, in any event, this young man, I suggest to you that this young man came, and he's not listed as a friend, but perhaps, and this is my thought, that this was somebody who knew of Job, who was an admirer of who Job was, because Job was a man that people might want to emulate. Now look at the chapter 29. I think Elihu would have been here very possibly for this reason. Now, you can't prove it, but when you look at who Job was and what he said of himself, and I don't think Job is speaking, is exaggerating what he's saying here. He speaks in a literary sense. I mean, it's flowing, it's graphic. But he says some things in the 29th chapter, and I want to just pick a few of them out for you. If you look at the second verse, Job is toward the end of his discourse, and he says, "Oh, that I were as in months past." Months. Apparently this suffering went on for a time. You notice it says months. One of the times you see in here very clearly that Job's suffering lasted a while. It wasn't just 2 weeks or 3 days or 6 days. He said, "Oh, as I were in months past, in the days when God watched over me." Ooh. See something there? When God watched over me, he isn't anymore, but he used to. There's something there you can see. Now, if you skip down and look at verse 7. "When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and hid. The aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hands in their mouth." And you skip down to verse 14. These are just some of the things. "I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, I was feet to the lame, I was father to the poor." A little bit further down, verse 21. "Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel." And then verse 25. "I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners." This man was a respected man. He sat in the gates of the city. And remember, we saw somebody else that did that some time back. A man named Lot had a similar position to this. This was a respected man. Now, putting it in that context, this man Elihu, a younger man, may very well have been there because he knew of Job and he respected this man. And he was there because of the admiration that he had for this man. Now, that's a suggestion. We don't really know from Scripture. But in some fashion, something brought this man there. And I'm going to suggest that would be the most likely thing. Now, before we see what this man did in accusing Job of his conduct or saying anything to him, I want to go back and look just quickly at just a synopsis of what the men said about him before we look at what Elihu's going to say. Because when you see what these three men said about Job, then you'll see the real contrast that is there. And you'll see what is recorded in the 32nd chapter is. Because the accusations of these men are going to be just vague, general, and they're not going to have any evidence for what they're saying. Now, I don't know about you folks, but the one thing I hate to be accused of more than anything else is to be accused of doing something wrong and they don't have any proof that I did it. But they say, "Well, you did this. This happened because you've done this. You must have done this because..." But they never give you a reason for it. They never show you that you did anything, but you get accused. Now, if you look at the first time Eliphaz, and he's apparently the oldest and appears to be the wisest because God speaks to him. Back in the 4th chapter, he's going to say something. And as you go through the book of Job, there are many, 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 many cases where there is a lot of discourse. But there's a main point followed by a lot of discourse, which gives examples or illustrations. And they're going to be illustrations from the time these men live. And some of them are going to be very, very difficult for us to understand. Let me tell you something. The Hebrew text here is wicked. In the sense we use it today, David's laughing. He knows what I mean. I mean wicked as in it is difficult. It is very difficult to deal with because it is so different from standard Hebrew. It's a Chaldean kind of Hebrew. And it shows, it's just very hard to deal with. But it's well worth dealing with. But it's difficult. But so what we're going to do is we're going to pick some of the high points out and the examples and illustrations we're going to pass by. Now, one thing we should remember, the first time someone says something is usually they're going to say the most important thing first. For example, if a man's on trial in court and he's being charged with something, the prosecutor is going to, the first thing he's going to say is what? He's going to say the most important thing, the thing he wants to make stick. And everything else is going to follow after that. So it's going to be in this case, that these three men, the first thing they're going to say is going to be the guideline, and everything else they're going to say is going to be in keeping with that. Now, you know, there's a place in the New Testament that illustrates how that works. And one of my favorite illustrations of this is found over in Ephesians. If you want to look there for just a second, just to read the verse. In Ephesians chapter 1, Paul does the same thing. And I think sometimes in the study of Scripture, if we look at the first thing that is said about a subject and stop and say, is this the theme for what's going to be said? Many times we'll find, yes, it is exactly what the whole book is going to be about. And I think in the book of Ephesians, you're going to see that. Now, I like the book of Ephesians, and I had the good fortune of filling in seminary for one day. And so I actually got to speak on this verse briefly, Dave. And so this sticks in my mind because I had the privilege of sharing this with seminary men. But look at the third verse. Paul has introduced himself to the church, and he said, grace and peace is to you. Now, what's the first thing he says? Blessed is, please understand, there aren't any bees buzzing around here. It's blessed is, the lack of a verb in most languages, including Greek, means that you supply an is. Not a wish, not a be, but an is. So blessed is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places or in the heavenlies in Christ. All spiritual blessings. What are all the spiritual blessings? Read the book of Ephesians. You'll see a good number of them, won't you? See what I'm saying? First three chapters. Here it is right here in verse 3 of chapter 1. It is a summary of what Paul's going to talk about. He's going to tie into the fact you have all spiritual blessings. Well, what are they? Well, he's going to talk about them. And of course, he's going to go through and mention how we're seated in the heavenlies in Christ and we're raised up. In the second chapter where it says we're seated in the heavenlies and the ages to come, he's going to show the exceeding riches of his kindness, and on it goes. But the theme starts back there. And the point we're making is the first time something is said in a discourse frequently is the most important and sets the way you should understand it. Now, when that's said, Eliphaz, back in Job chapter 4, he has a flowery introduction, as these men did. These were intelligent men. But he says something. He gets to the point in verse 7 and in verse 8. He says, remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off? Even as I've seen, those who plow perversity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish. Now, he does use some words here, and I like the way they're translated. It is the word that should be translated innocent. And the word for upright is the word we saw that God used. It's yashar, if you know your Hebrew a little bit. And it has the idea of someone that is honest or straightforward. Job was an honest and straightforward man. He didn't make excuses. He avoided evil. He didn't make excuses and try and find a way to do it, even though he knew it was wrong. He was straight. He was honest and straightforward. So now the question here is, well, whoever perished, who's he talking to? Who's the one that's perished? What is he saying? He's saying, Job, you got it because you are not upright and you are not innocent. And then he says, even as I've seen those who plow perversity. Now, the word iniquity, it's a fun word in the Hebrew. It shows up in the New Testament as well. Frequently, it's this word alwen. It's a Hebrew word that means something that is twisted or distorted. And most of the time, it refers to something inside of us as human beings. The Old Testament believer understood something. They understood that something was twisted about man. Something was perverted. We'd call it a fallen human nature. Now, if you hold your finger here, you should see this one. Back in Genesis chapter 4, there's a verse that I always mistaught in my earlier years of teaching because I didn't take the time to check my Hebrew. And I'll tell you what, man, you guys that are teachers, don't overlook your Hebrew in the Old Testament. You'll miss some gems. But in Genesis chapter 4, when you think about this first man, this is probably the most graphic illustration that I know of the twisted pervertedness of man, because when Cain is confronted by God, and God says, what have you done with your brother? His blood cries from the ground, and he's told what's going to happen to him. And then verse 13 of Genesis 4, it says, and Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Now, that sounds as though he's crying the blues. But that's not exactly what he says, because that word punishment is this word perversity. I believe you missed the point if we say punishment. I don't think that's what Cain is talking about. He's talking about my perversity, that what I am inside, what I am is greater than I can bear. The twistedness. It's not as punishment at all. That word is not translated punishment. It doesn't mean punishment. It's something that's twisted. And I think evidently at this point, Cain knew something a lot of Christians never learn. They've got an old nature. They've got a twisted nature that they can't do anything with. By the way, Satan learned something there too, because if you read on in the fourth chapter, you find that Satan realized he had a problem on his hands. there was a twistedness in the humans that he couldn't control. He had these people where he wanted them. They were his. They were fallen. He could work with them. Wait a minute. They're twisted. I can't do anything with them. So now he's going to make the world system. Very fascinating thing back there. But you would miss it all if you don't understand that one word, punishment, is not punishment. It's the word perversity. It's a twistedness. It's a very descriptive term. When you think of something as twisted, that's not a very pretty picture. I don't like looking at a pretzel. Especially if you think about your back when you're lifting things. Well, you guys know what I'm talking about if your back's ever felt like a pretzel. You know exactly what I mean. Well, so coming back then to Job chapter 4. Eliphaz is saying, Job, you're twisted, you're not innocent, you're perverted. But now, if you read on down through the text, you're not going to find one single piece of evidence that this man offers. How wonderful for a friend to sit there and say, Job, because you're twisted, distorted, because you're living a rotten life, you're getting punished because you're doing it. That's not exactly comfort in my book. And there's no evidence of it either. Now that's not very nice. And everything he's going to say following that, and he's going to speak three times to this book, is going to be in keeping with that. He's never going to improve upon that. He's never going to go beyond the original statement that says, you did something, there's something, you're twisted, you're rotten, you did something, and you're getting what you have coming. Right? He doesn't say what that was that he did. Now in the eighth chapter, you find the next man speaking, that's Bildad. And Bildad is not a whole lot nicer, because what he has to say in verses 4, 5, and 6 are not nice at all. But what you don't see, the English text has a slight problem here. And let me read it somewhat closer to what it would be in the Hebrew. It says, if your sons, verse 4, if your sons have sinned against him, and if he's cast them away for their transgression, if you would seek God, earnestly seek God, and make your supplication, if you were pure and upright, then surely now he would awake for you. All those things in verse 4 and 5 in the Hebrew are connected together. Because the way you read it in the New King James, it says, he's cast them away for their transgression. He doesn't say that. He's connecting these things together. He's building his case. He says, if your sons have sinned, and if he's cast them away, and if you would earnestly seek God, and if you would make your supplications, and if you were pure and upright. He's just building up a whole line of things. He's not just saying one thing. He's building a whole string of things up, and he's loading them on. Oh, no, it's not enough to say, if your sons have sinned, well, he's going to add to it. How about you? You're not such a hot guy either. You're not seeking God. You're not making supplication. You're not pure and upright. Verse 6. But if you were, then God would rise up and help you out. Now, if you see it in the Hebrew text, it's much more graphic. Because it's all strung together. If your sons have sinned, and if he's cast them away, and if you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication, and if you were pure and upright, then God would do something for you. It's a lot more harsh. It's a lot more harsh than we read in English. It's bad enough in English, but it's worse when you look at the Hebrew text. Now, if you read down through here, what evidence does this man have for any of what he says? If you read the eighth chapter, you find absolutely no evidence. But he said, your sons have sinned and you've done something wrong. He's cast them away because of what they've done. He doesn't say what they've done either, by the way. And if you were pure and upright, well, God said this man was, but he's saying, well, you weren't because of your suffering, so you couldn't have been. There's a common thread here. Somehow these men are assuming that if somebody suffered, this is pre-law, then they had to have been wicked. It never occurred to these men, it never occurs to any of them, that there could be suffering for some other reason. But Eliphaz is going to say something later that actually indicates he did know that that was possible, that someone could suffer for another reason. Now, what about the other man, Zophar? Well, Zophar in chapter 11 has said something that is astonishing to me. Unfortunately, our English text doesn't reflect it, and I had to go to a Hebrew source that is impeccable and was beyond question and repute. I had to ask Dave about this one. I translated this and I couldn't believe what I was reading. I said, this can't be. This can't be saying that. And I asked Pastor Dave, who's taught Hebrew, and I said, does it say this? He says, he made a very profound thing. And I'll give Dave credit. He said something very profound. He said, it says what it means. I thought that was tremendously profound. He said, that's what he told me. It means what it says. And so it's something to see this verse. In the sixth verse of Hebrews, or Job 11, rather, this verse reads and says that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, that he would double your prudence. Now, the last statement that he makes here is not at all It is not at all in the English text. This is just completely different. And it's a stunning difference. And let me give you something of a translation. It should read something along the line, "You know that God will be cause to forget for you your perversity." God will be cause to forget your perversity. Wait a second. What does that mean? This man is saying something awfully strange to my boy. But it's the Hebrew text. He's actually saying, you know, Job, you know that God somehow you know that God will be caused. He'll cause himself. It's a causal verb. That is, the forget verb is the causal form in the Hebrew. He'll be caused to forget, or he'll be made to forget your perversity. I got a real problem with that, folks. You mean that God just turns his back and overlooks perversity? Now, the only thing I can think of, and I don't see any reason to suppose that, the only thing I can think of is that could be some kind of an obscure reference to the fact that Zophar thought that Job would go out and make some kind of an offering to make things right, to cover over his perversity. But that's not even hinted in the text. And I don't think it's fair to say that. So what this man says, all he does say about Job, he says, your perversity, God somehow is going to overlook it. I'm afraid God doesn't go around overlooking sin and perversity and rights. I'm afraid God doesn't quite do that. Not for Job, not for anybody. But this man says that God's going to do it for you. Now, what you read in the English text makes a better story. It says, God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. But unfortunately, friends, that is not even close to the text. It's not close to the text. It's that God, you know that God will be caused to forget for you, and for your advantage, your perversity. God's going to overlook it. Well, unfortunately, as the others, does he give any evidence? If you read down through this, and I trust you'll take time to read some of these things, you're going to find that so far, like the rest of them, he's going to go on with all kinds of flowery speech and all kinds of pretty examples, but he doesn't have any evidence. Now, you know, that makes me wonder at this point. I wonder, were these men politicians? Doesn't it sound like these men are politicians? They say a bunch of things without any evidence? No, that's tongue-in-cheek, folks. That was a bad one. But I just couldn't. That just struck me. Having listened to the political debate and having listened to some of the things that are going on, I said, these men should have been politicians. They aren't answering anything. They're just giving you a bunch of generalities. They don't answer anything anybody would want to know. Well, let's take a look at this fourth comfort then. Turning over to the 32nd chapter, and we're going to be picking through the 32nd through the 37th chapter. And we're going to have to do it purposely because there are so many details that we just can't take them all up. But I wanted you to get an idea of this man. He was different. Because as we said, you're going to see, I believe it's going to show up in here, that Eliphaz is not going to be saying to Job, because you're a dirty rat, you're suffering now. He's going to tell him, Job, what you're doing and your suffering is not right. And I don't believe, now there's one passage that might be contradictory to that, but we'll look at that in a second, but I don't believe you're going to find an instance where Eliphaz says to Job, you sinned and therefore you're suffering. It's not in there. But what is said about him is because of what he's doing while he's suffering. But as you come to the 32nd chapter then, we read a little bit in this, and you'll notice that when these men got finished speaking in the first verse, what happens in the 32nd verse, the second chapter, and our second verse, and the third verse of the 32nd chapter, is you see that Eliphaz, his wrath is kindled. Now that's a fun word, that word wrath. Dave mentioned that before, and it's nostril. Now, I have a hard time thinking his nostril was kindled. Well, it's this picture, and it's an image that we have. I always think of this. When I think of this, I think of somebody fuming, like, or a fire-breathing dragon. You know, the dragons will breathe fire out their mouth and their nose. And so somehow I'm seeing this person. I get this comic, almost a cartoon image. Now, you have to pardon me because I have a sense of humor that goes into the goofy stuff. But I can just see somebody with fire coming out of his nose. I can see this young guy going, with the fire rolling out of his nose. That may not be an inaccurate picture entirely. But his wrath is kindled, and you notice why it's kindled. And it's very, 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 very good. He said he was aroused against Job because he justified himself rather than God. That's entirely different. He's justifying himself when? As he is acting after. He's acting during his suffering. He's justifying himself all the way through that. You can see that at the end of the 31st chapter when Job finally finishes speaking. He's saying, if I've done anything, then let everything go bad for me. Let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. If I've done anything wrong, Job is right to the end. He's defending himself. And by the way, if you want to put a reference in the margin, draw a line out and put 13:25. Because you see there in one verse, you see exactly what the problem with Job was the whole time he was up. It isn't that he has a problem with who God is. It is that he has a problem with what God is doing. Now, Job 13, I keep trying to find Hebrews in here, Dave. I don't know why that is. But Job chapter 13, I think the most clear and concise statement that you'll find about this man and his problem is Job chapter 13. And let's see, let's say verse 25. Did I get the right verse? I'm looking for... Oh, yeah, I'm right. Excuse me, there it is. I can't even read my own pages here. Job says in the 13th chapter, it's the 15th verse. Excuse me, not the 25th. If I said 13:25, I was wrong. It's 13:15. Now, Job is speaking and he says, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him." Very, very graphic. He says, even if he does do this to me, he says, I'm going to maintain what I do. I'm going to defend what I do. And it's graphic. It says, before the face of. Now, it's translated before him, but it implies before the face of, in front of him, the Hebrew expression. So what is Job saying here? He says, his problem wasn't that he had a lack of confidence in God. He says, even if he does slay me, I'm going to trust him. And he's going to say later on, I know I'm going to be resurrected. I know I'm going to see him face to face. But he says here, yet I will defend my own ways. Job has a problem with what God is doing, not with who God is. And that verse draws it together. And that's what you see here in 32, verse 2 and verse 3. Is that this man recognizes he is justifying himself. Job is righteous in his own eyes. He's justifying himself. And then his three friends, verse 3, also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they found no answer, yet condemned Job. So this man waits, and you can see here that he did so for a good reason. It says, now because they were years older than he, Eliphaz waited to speak to Job. So he is going to show a little respect. But when he first starts to speak, the first thing this man is going to do is he's not going to go after Job immediately. He's going after the three friends, which I find that to be fascinating. Because he goes down through here and you'll notice what he says in verse 7. Age should speak, and the multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there's a spirit in man, and the breath of Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do aged understand justice. Therefore I say, listen to me, I will also declare my opinion. Indeed, I've waited for your words. I've listened to your reasonings. Now notice he says he's listened to what they've said. So he's been there the whole time. But you haven't seen it. But he's been there. He said, I've listened to what you said. And while you searched out what to say, I paid close attention to you. And surely not one of you has convinced Job or answered his words. Now, he's being polite, but now he's turning to them and says, I've listened to what you said, and you guys haven't done anything. Now, there's something back here that is, to me, is extremely fascinating. In verse 8, it says, there is a spirit in man, and the breath of Almighty gives him understanding. Now, the word for breath here is an unusual word. It's a Hebrew word that doesn't occur that often. And it does have the idea of breath or spirit or mind. And I'm wondering if this man understood something that was written many, many, many centuries later. 2 Timothy 3:16 says all scripture is what? Is breathed out by God. Is God breathed? God has breathed it out. I'm wondering if this man is saying something back here. Now, this is a suggestion. I wouldn't teach it as a fact, but I'm wondering about this. It says the breath from the Almighty, truth that is breathed out from God. Is it possible this man understood that the truth was breathed out from God? Well, I'm not sure that you could say it is, and I'm not sure you could say it is not. But it makes me suspicious because it's not the normal word for spirit. It's breath. And I wonder, could it possibly have been this man understood that God breathed out truth? Well, he understood God was a source of truth. And if he's actually saying that there's a breath, that the truth is breathed out from God, then this man understood an awful lot. He understood something that is not going to be recorded for quite some time. But regardless of what that says, this man, he's not a theologian. He's not even a Jew. He might also be referring to the Holy Spirit. And I thought about that and I thought, now, is it possible? Because he's not a theologian. Now, I wouldn't say that that's possible necessarily, but Whatever it is, he does understand it's the Almighty that gives wisdom. And this young man was claiming that he was learned, that God had taught him some things, and that these guys that should have been older and wiser didn't know what they were talking about. He says, you didn't answer. You did not say one thing to this man that would answer what he had to say. So, to me, the first thing you see that's important about him is he recognized these other guys were completely wrong. Now, he's going to say something else, too, as you go down through the text, looking about what he has to say to them. In the 15th verse, he says, they're dismayed and answered no more. Words escaped them, and I waited till they did not speak, and they stood still and answered no more. And I won't add my part to it. And he's going to go on and tell you, if you look down at what follows, he has an interesting expression. He's like a wineskin full of new wine. And as wine ferments, it lets off a gas and it expands. And he said, I'm like that. My belly's like a wineskin that has no vent on it. So he was ready to burst. This man sat here, and what he's telling these guys is, I've listened to you guys go on, and you haven't said anything that's contradicted this man, and I'm ready to burst if I don't say something. Now he's going to turn to Job and start to speak to him as well. And what he has to say to Job now, he begins in the 33rd chapter. He's going to start speaking to Job. And he's going to tell him some very important things as he speaks. He says, beginning at the first verse, but please, Job, hear my speech. Now he's talking to Job. So consider, folks, what you see from the 32nd chapter all the way through it, he's talking to those three friends, and he's essentially telling, you didn't know what you're talking about, and yet you condemned this man. And he's telling why he spoke. But now when you come to the 33rd chapter, it says, Job, please hear my speech and listen to my words. Now I open my mouth, my tongue speaks in my mouth, my words come from an upright heart, my lips utter pure knowledge, the Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. If you can answer me, set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Truly, I am your spokesman before God. I'm like your spokesman before God. I've also been formed out of clay. Surely no fear of me will terrify you, nor will my hand be heavy upon you. Now, so he's saying, okay, Job, here I am. I'm going to speak. You answer me if you can. I'm on your side. I'm not going to be heavy-handed on you like these guys were. And as he's going to go down, as he's going down through here, he said back, and let me see, I skipped over something I wanted to say, that he said he's not going to answer with their words. I missed something. You should see, back in the 32nd chapter, the 14th verse, he says to these men and to Job, he said, now, he has not directed his words against me, so I will not answer him with your words. Elihu told these three friends, I am not going to take what you've got to say and say to him. I'm not going to take your words. I'm going to say anything that you said. And he tells Job, I'm on your side, essentially. You could paraphrase it by saying that. Now, the first thing he's going to say to Job, it's going to be directly related to what was going on in his suffering. Look what he says, beginning at verse 8. Now, he's speaking to Job. Surely you've spoken in my hearing, and I've heard the sound of your words, saying, I am pure, I am without transgression, I am innocent, and there's no perversity in me. Yet he finds occasion against me. He counts me as an enemy. He puts my feet in stocks. He watches my paths. Did Job say that? Yes, he did say that type of thing. He didn't exactly say that, but he said those kind of things, that God was treating him though he's an enemy. Now look what the first answer is. Here's your first answer. Why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting of his words. He does not give an accounting of any of his words. I would paraphrase that by saying, God doesn't answer for what he does. God, that's the first answer for this man. Now, if you stop and think about that, if you say that God doesn't answer for what he does, that is a pretty good statement to make. That's a pretty fair statement to make. But you'll notice that he's not talking about what got Job into this condition. He's talking about what Job was doing while he was in this condition. And what he's going to say from this point forward is going to follow that pattern. He's not going to suddenly change and go back and say, no, you did this before. No, he's doing this because what we saw over in the 32nd chapter, he was justifying himself. And he did that. At the very end, the last thing he said, he was justifying himself. I didn't do anything wrong at all. But God counts him as an enemy. So he goes on to say some other things, but the first thing he has to say is that. Now, if you skip ahead a little bit more, he's going to say something to Job. He's going to start saying it, talk about it in the 19th verse of the 33rd chapter. He says, man is also chastened with pain on his bed. And he starts talking about chastening. And then he says in verse 29, the answer is found there, that God chastens his own for their good. That's the second answer. The first answer is that God doesn't give an accounting. He doesn't sit there and tell everybody why he did what he did. He doesn't have to. He just doesn't do that. Now, sometimes we'd like God to do that, but he doesn't do that. And the second answer is God can chasten his own for their good. Because he says in verse 29, behold, God works all these things twice, in fact, three times with a man to bring his soul back from the pit that he may be enlightened with the light of life. Now, he's talking about the pit. He's talking about the grave. He's saying something that we would probably understand better in our terminology if we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 32. That God chastens his own, and sometimes many sleep. Some, or not many, but some sleep. We find it in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 11. It talks about God will chasten his own. Now, what is it saying here? God is chastened. He says, God, Eliphaz says, God chastens a man to keep him from dying prematurely, to put it in our terminology. So God has the right to chasten his own. That's the message he has here. Now, I'm not sure whether Job would have liked any of these answers, but can we argue that this is a bad answer? That God has a right to chasten his own for his own? Now, remember, this is pre-law. If what we're saying here is correct, and you can read through this and look at it, you can see that, well, that's what he's saying. He's saying God will chasten his own. He has the right to do that. Now, Job didn't seem to understand that. And understand, in his circumstances, I don't know if anybody could have done as well as Job did, much less better. But he just didn't understand. Now, if you come to the end of the 33rd chapter, he offers Job a chance to speak. He says in the 31st verse, he said, give ear, Job, listen to me. Hold your peace, I will speak. If you have anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify you. Speak, for I desire to justify. In other words, I'm on your side. Say, if you've got something to say, say it. But now Job doesn't say anything. But he gives him a chance to do it. He's asking him for the chance. Now, there's going to be another answer coming up because he's going to come back and start speaking again. And what we see is that he flows from subject to subject. And what I'm doing is picking out just the high points where it seems as though he crescendos and makes a specific point in what he says. And you can read through this, but I found about six specific things that are said here. And we're going to hurriedly try to get to them all. Because when you see them all, this man, everything he's going to say is pretty much right on the money. And you can see why God wouldn't say anything to him, because he's not talking about, Job, you did this, and because you did this, you're suffering. No, he's saying, Job, what you said about God, the first thing, what you said he's teaching enemies, he says, that is not right. And that's true. It wasn't right. He didn't say the right thing. And then he says, God has the right to chasten his own. Now, he's going to have another answer. And in 34th chapter, down in the 10th verse, he's going to include the wise men in this too. Because if you look at the second verse, we should notice that his third answer, he's going to drag them into the question too. Because, hear my words, you wise men, give ear to me, you that have knowledge. So he's going to drag them back in. And then he says in the 10th verse, Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to commit perversity. Now, it's a fascinating thing, because what you have here, that far be it, is one Hebrew word. And it reminds me very much of something you see in the New Testament. It's where Paul uses God forbid, as it's translated into King James. It's two words. It's meganoito. It's a Greek word. Well, this is a single Hebrew word. And has somewhat the same idea. And I looked at it and I said, well, I didn't realize that the Old Testament had an equivalent to God forbid. But it's the same idea. It says, God forbid, I guess you could almost translate this, God forbid that God would do wickedness. And really what it actually says is more literally, it says, wickedness is far from God. And then in the 12th verse it says, surely God will never do wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. So what he says in the 10th verse, he says, wickedness is far from God. Perversity is far from God. And it's the idea is there. It's far from God. He's just making a blanket statement. This is far from God. Then he's going to say that God won't do wicked. God won't pervert justice. In other words, very simple answer. God doesn't do things that are wicked or perverse. Now that includes the three friends. And now his friends had a problem because, well, they had God. One of them has God just saying God's going to somehow forget all these things you did wrong. And they're all accusing him, and they're all assuming that because a man suffers because he's done something wrong. And they have a number of errors in there, but so he's pointing, so he includes them in this answer, which I find to be fascinating, because God doesn't do anything. God never does anything that's wrong. Now, when you look at that, once again, is that a bad answer? Is there anything wrong with what he says? No, I think what he's saying is accurate to this man. Because Job is accusing God, in essence, he's accused God of not being fair with him, of counting him as an enemy, and yet God doesn't do wickedly. God doesn't twist, doesn't pervert what judgment or justice should be. It's the word for judgment, frequently translated that. God doesn't do that. Now, he's going to have a fourth answer if you come down a little bit further into the 34th chapter. There's a transition in down through this text. And when you get toward the end of the chapter, we find in verse 33, should he repay you according to your terms, just because you disavow it, you must choose it and not I, therefore speak what you know. Now, what he has done, if you read down through the text, he gets back into the subject of chastening again in about the 26th, 27th verses. And he talks a little bit about chastening again. Then he said, we should have read verse 30. It says that the hypocrite should not reign lest the people should be ensnared. For as anyone said to God, I have borne, and they supplied chastening, I will offend no more. Teach me what I did not see. If I've done perversity, I will do it no more. Should he repay you according to your terms? Now, the word terms in the New King James is supplied, but it's not a bad idea. It's somewhat close to it. The context, you know, it's essentially what he's saying here is God will act on his terms and not yours. In essence, that's what he's saying to Job. Now, that's an answer that's not easy to accept, but when you stop and think about it, does God have to ask any of his creatures, do I have the right to do this? No, he doesn't. Does he have to explain to them? Does he have to act the way we think on our terms? Now, it suggests perhaps even that Job was expecting something back. Should he repay you on your terms? Is he going to act on your terms? In other words, is he going to give you back what you've lost? Now, we find out that God did at the end of this book. You find out he got back everything he lost double, except for his children. He got back the same number he lost. Which is interesting, because he had 10 kids and he got 10 back, but he had everything else doubled. Why did he only get 10 kids back when he got everything else doubled? Why didn't he have 20 kids? Well, because he probably didn't lose those kids. Those were believers. It's been suggested that, and I think that's a pretty good explanation. He only got back 10 children, and that's just an aside, but he got back 10 because if they were saved, he didn't really lose them. If you have a family member that goes home to be with the Lord, you haven't lost them. Not at all. They're at the right hand of God. Well, you're there too, aren't you? You haven't lost them. You may not see them for a while, but you haven't lost somebody. Interesting thought with Job. He only got back exactly what he lost in children, but he got back double in all his possessions. Well, nonetheless, so what you see here is a fourth reason, is that God doesn't pay you back. God doesn't act on your terms. He doesn't give you back because you want it back. His arm's not going to be twisted. I'll tell you what, friends. I wish a lot of people today that wrote books of theology, supposed theology, would understand the simple principle that God doesn't act like a man does because we want him to. He doesn't do what we think he should do because we want him to do it. I'm so tired of people trying to make God a good friend of ours, a good buddy that you can put your arms on his shoulder and say, well, you know, God, now how about doing this for me, pal? And he says, oh, okay, yeah, I'll make an exception for you. Well, I'm glad God doesn't do that, because there's a lot of people that be putting their arm around God's shoulder trying to get things that wouldn't be very good for the rest of us Christians. Well, Job's going to, he's going to include something now, too, that as you look down through here, he includes the men again. He draws those three friends back in again, because look at the 34th verse of the 34th chapter. Men of understanding, say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge. Now he's drawing them back in. But there's something here that is very fascinating. Job speaks without knowledge, his words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. Now that word for tried, that's a word that we would know in the New Testament, dokimazo, to test something for approval. It's a Hebrew word very much akin to what you'd have in the English in the New Testament. Is that he was being tried, he's being tested for approval. Now, apparently, in some way, Eliphaz understood somehow that God was testing this man, trying him, but the same way that you and I can be tried. Because you find in 2 Peter, it talks about that our faith may be more precious than gold, though it be tried with fire. It's tested for approval. It's not tested for failure. So the idea here is, these men, he says to them, men, I wish that Job were tried because his answers are like the answers of wicked men. Now you notice his answers. Now notice verse 37. Now this almost sounds like he's accusing Job of sin before his suffering. But I don't think that's the case. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He clapped his hand among us and multiplies his words against God. Notice, his words against God. Eliphaz does say, this is the normal word for sin in the Old Testament. He's adding rebellion to his sin. Now what is the sin here? He multiplies his words against God. It's not something he did before. Not something he did before his suffering began, but he's adding sin. He multiplies his words against God. This, if he's charging Job with sin, yes, it sounds to me like he is. He says he is. But when does the sin occur? It is in the words he's saying about what God is like, about what God is doing. And remember, he still said, though he slay me, I will trust him. But I will maintain, I will set my own ways up for judgment in front of his face. So he does kind of, but the thing that is important to see in this, and this is before he gets another answer, this transition, is that Eliphaz seems to have the idea and understanding that this man was being tested for some reason, that God was trying to test him, and that he wants him to pass the test. Because what Job is doing is he's answering like a wicked man. He's adding rebellion to his sin. That's exactly what this man is saying. And I believe that's how we should understand it. Now, you're going to find In the 35th chapter, he's going to continue on this statement. Here is an example of what he's talking about. Moreover, it says in verse, and he's continuing the idea, he's adding rebellion to his sin. And what is the sin that this man has? It says, moreover, Eliphaz answered and said, do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? Well, he's accusing Job of saying that. That's what it sounds to me like. It's pretty tough. And he's going to go on from that point, and he's building to a case where if you come down to the text a little further, he's going to find a statement that is very plain, and it is going to be, I believe, an answer to this man. In verse 7, he's made this transition. He's accusing Job of sin in his speech, and he says in verse 4, we should notice that he said, Let's read verse 3 and 4 down through verse 7. Let's read the context. That will be easier, I suppose. It says, for you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? I will answer you and your companions with you. Now he brings those three friends in again. Look to the heavens and see, and behold the clouds. They are higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? And what do you receive? And what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and righteousness affects the Son of Man. What is he saying when he gets to this? I believe there's a simple answer in this text that you could paraphrase by saying, what you do, you can't give anything to God. We don't give anything to God. We don't add anything to God, and our conduct doesn't take anything away from his person, from his character, from what he is. God doesn't need anything from man, is the answer he has here. Essentially what he's saying, Job somehow in all this has put himself in a place of importance. And by elevating himself, I think the reason that what you see back here in Eliphaz says, or Elihu rather says, that your righteousness is greater than God's, he's setting himself up where he's so important that it's as though when Job is right, he's doing something for God's benefit. He's helping God out, as it were. Now that's, I don't know, that's an easy trap to get into. I think sometimes we hear Christian leaders and so forth today that are working for God and they're doing things on God's behalf. And we better remember something. God really doesn't need anybody. He doesn't require what we can do. Because as he goes down through here, he says in verse 7, if you're righteous, what do you give to him? Does God receive some benefit if Job is a righteous man? Does God get something for it that he needs? Does God need this man to be righteous for his own sake? For God's own sake. The answer is no, he doesn't. Does this man take something away from God if he is not righteous? And the answer again is no, he does not. So when you look at this, the answer is pretty simple. God doesn't need anything from man, and man's conduct doesn't take anything away from God. God is not changed by that. And yet Job seems to have missed that fact, and so do these other men. They seem to have somehow misunderstood and thought, well, God needs something from me. But you know, this is a pretty accurate statement. Now remember, folks, these things that are spoken, these things are spoken pre-law. There is a lot in this book that's pre-law, and you see in these relationships between God and man, these things that are said are essentially still true today. It is true today that God doesn't need anything I can do. You know, one of the hardest things to learn in the spiritual life is that if we put our hands in the working of salvation, if we put our hands in the benefits package, the benefits that we have as a Christian, if we put our hands in there and try to manipulate them and try and help God out, guess what that does? Oh, it makes him better, doesn't it? No, it ruins him. Grace doesn't involve works. God doesn't need my help in my salvation. If I try to get my fingers in and say, well, I can do this for God, and I can do this, and I can go over here, and God will bless me if I do this. And so God bless me when I do this because I'm going to do it anyway. Is God going to bless me for that reason? Does God need my help? I'm afraid he doesn't. I'm afraid what is said back here is true today. And I'm afraid if I don't do what I should do, God's not going to sit there and say, oh, no, he missed this thing. And I needed it so bad for Donald Ackroyd. I needed it so bad for him to do the right, and he didn't do it. No, God didn't need me to do anything right. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't want me to do what is right. I'm not saying he doesn't want you to do what is right. But the point is that this is something that stands the test of time. This is still true. These things are as true that this man is saying. And yet, it's so long ago. Funny how those things didn't change. Some things just never do change. Well, in the final scheme of things, there's one more answer coming up. And it's going to be in the 36th chapter. And we encourage you to read through these chapters because there's so many things in here that are so wonderful. The exchange that is here, there are other things along the way that if you miss them, you're missing something good. The book of Job is not a date book at all. And yet it was the first book written in the Bible. But remember what it says in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12. What does it say about the Word of God? It's living. When you read this book, it's still alive. And yet it was written so long ago. Well, there's something in here that I don't want to skip over in the 36th chapter. Under law, when a man was obedient to God, what would happen to a man that was obedient under law? He got spiritual blessings, right? Wrong. Wrong. When a man under law or a woman under law was obedient to the law, kept all the provisions of it, their benefits consisted of material blessing. And you can find that back in Deuteronomy 28, my favorite place to go. If you have any doubt about it, you ever want to show somebody the difference, take them straight to Deuteronomy 28. Did you know Deuteronomy 28 has 15 verses that talk about the benefit? 5, 10. I don't have 15 fingers, but I'll hold up 10. There's 15 verses that talk about the benefits a person gets if they're obedient under law. And then from the 16th verse to about the 57th verse, there's like 41 or more verses that talk about the curses of the law. So it's almost three times as many curses as there are blessings. Law was not such a hot thing when you get right down to it. But if you ever want to show somebody the difference between the believer today and the believer in the Old Testament, just take them to Deuteronomy 28. Show them the difference. What they got was strictly material blessings. And yet, if you look here, in verse 10 of the 36th chapter, before we get to the final answer, I didn't want to skip this because this shows you something fascinating. A believer before the law, this is what they expected in their life. Now notice it says, he opens their ears to instruction. Now, Elihu is still talking about God and how he doesn't mistreat anybody. And he said, he opens their ears to instruction and commands them that they return from iniquity. If they obey him, if they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in good. Translated prosperity is the word good. And their years in pleasures. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword. They shall die without knowledge. So if somebody was obedient to the Lord, God would prosper that person. If they weren't, it says they'll die by the sword. Well, you know what happened to Job's kids? A bunch of raiders came in. You go back in Old Testament history, you find there were wars all the time and there were raiders all over the place. But the point we're making here is this concept is obedience to God brought physical prosperity. Disobedience to God could bring a premature death. Now that's the same thing that happened under the law, isn't it? First seven commandments had a death penalty attached to them. I think sometimes, folks, that some of our present-day theologians would be happier if they lived before the law. Because back there, just think of it. You put these guys today that teach health and wealth theology. Put them back pre-law. They'd be happy back there because, number one, there aren't any rules except you fear God and shun evil. They'd be happy with that. And they'd also be happy with the fact that if they were obedient to what they did know, then they'd have health and wealth. Isn't that what it says? This is true in the Old Testament. And true before the law. So when we think of the people before the law, these people, they had a good understanding of what it meant to be obedient. They didn't have all the rules. They didn't have revelation written down for them. But yet still, they understood something of what they should do. And they understood, their concept was that God blessed those who were obedient with material possessions. Now, when people do that today, please remember, Ephesians 1:3 says we are blessed with all spiritual blessings. There's no place in the New Testament that says you're going to be blessed financially because you're obedient. It just isn't there. Well, our last answer then, and our time's getting away from us, it comes down in the 36th chapter, and it's found in around verse 24, and you're going to find that it's stated in an interesting fashion. As he comes down through here, he's talking about all of the problems Job had, and in verse 21 he says, take heed, do not turn to perversity or iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction. And then he comes down and he makes a statement that is surprising. He says, verse 24, remember to magnify, to make great his work, of which men have sung. Everyone has seen it. Man looks on it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we do not by experience know him. This is an Old Testament word for know that has the idea of to know by experience. We don't know him by experience, nor can the number of his years be discovered. Last answer, I think, is a very simple one. To paraphrase it into our English, what God does and who God is beyond our comprehension. We do not understand who God is by our experience, and we don't know why he does what he does. It implies something in there to me, too. It implies that if he told me, I probably wouldn't understand it anyway, would I? Probably not. If God told me everything he did to me and everything he did to you, if he told you that, and everything he's doing today in our world, would we even be able to understand all of it? I don't know. I don't think so. But I think the final answer is God's ways are beyond comprehension. Now, Job probably at the time, I don't know that he was probably too happy with that answer. But it's the truth, isn't it? You know, God, when you add all these things together, he's built a case right up to the point where he comes to the end and says the final answer to everything is, pal, his ways are beyond anything we can understand. That brings into focus for us today as believers a simple word. It's called faith. You know, when God deals with us today, it's not for the same thing as Job. Hopefully it's not in the same circumstances as what Job had. But we don't always understand why things happen. But I realize, I don't always know what God is doing, and I don't understand why, but I probably couldn't if he told me. But he's not going to tell me anyway. But the final answer is, if I have faith, I realize he is great. Now, there's a lot of things I can add to it as a believer. I should understand, of course, that he said the things in Romans 8:28 that are true. If I'm a spiritual believer, if I'm directing love to God, things are going to work out for my good. I understand that. I believe that. But then I don't necessarily know why things happen the way they do. There's a lot of things that I would like to have differently. But I don't necessarily have that. So I think this man has heard some important things. And the last thing that he says, if you look at the last, at 37:24, the last thing that Elihu says, and Elihu speaks, and it's what is fascinating is he introduces the concept of a storm down through here. And when God speaks to Job, guess what he does? He speaks to him out of a whirlwind, something like a storm. It's almost as though God picked up where this man left off and comes into the picture and starts talking to him. It's fascinating to me. But the last thing he says is down in verse 24. He says, therefore, men fear him. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. Now, he does close, and we should read some of the verses prior to that, because he says in verse 23, as for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He's excellent in power and in judgment and abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear him. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. You know, in other words, God is not looking down on this man. To Job, the final thing he has to say, Job, you're not being mistreated. God doesn't do that. God doesn't do that. Well, and that's a good thing to remember. So what have we seen in the book of Job? Well, we've seen that this man suffered for a reason. But in the ultimate sense of things, he didn't suffer for what he had done wrong. And he really didn't suffer because of the things he'd said that were wrong while he was suffering. He suffered for an entirely different reason. And if you want to know the answer to that, you go back and look at the first two times Satan came. Because the real reason Job suffered was not for any reason other than the fact that God baited Satan. Satan took the bait and Satan tempted him because Satan said that he would curse you to your face if you took his health away from him. Did Job ever do that? No, he didn't. And all of these things that happened in here, I'm sure when it was all said and done, if Job himself wrote this book down or someone wrote it down later, he was amazed to find out everything that was involved. You know, we don't always understand what God does in our life, but the important thing to remember is we don't have to understand everything. Because if we know our Father, and we have one important word, faith, if we believe that what he does is right, and it is, if we believe what Romans 8:28 says is true, and it is, if we're loving God, then even though we have problems, none of us will ever have any problems like Job, I don't think, but no matter what they are, faith can look at this and understand these answers that this man gave are surprisingly good for a man that lived before the law. And it's true today, God won't allow anything to happen to us that isn't for our best. Job is an interesting illustration of that. God has the right to do with his own as he sees fit. And this man responded overall in the right of things because God says so at the end. Even though he understood, Job understood what he said wasn't necessarily so good. At the end, he understood. God has the right to do with his own that which he chooses. But please remember, that which he does will always be right. Let's pray, shall we? Heavenly Father, we're thankful today that in a book so ancient as this, we see a picture, Father, of the understanding men had of God. And we see a younger man that before the law had a remarkable understanding of what you're like, Father. And he seemed to realize that you're not a God who deals unrightly. You're not a God who shows partiality. And you're not a God, Father, who will give your accounting to anybody. You are the supreme Father. You do what is right and you do what is best. And yet for us today, we're reminded of the things we know from the New Testament. That what you do for us is ultimately what is best, is ultimately what is right. And Father, if we're loving you as we ought to be as spiritual believers, we know that things will work out for good. And we may not always understand all of the particulars of that. But we realize, Father, that your ways are not ours and that your understanding is far above ours. And it helps us to understand, Father, that though we don't always understand these things, yet when we have faith as believers today, we have the benefit of knowing by faith that everything you do is right. And that can help us even in the worst of times. Bless in these things now, we ask for Jesus' sake.